When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the Library Science channel of New Books Network. My name is Jen Hoyer, and today I'm speaking with Emily Todd and Matteo Pangallo, editors of Teaching the History of the Book, published by the University of Massachusetts Press in 2023. With original contributions from a diverse range of teachers, scholars, and practitioners in literary studies, history, book arts, library science, language studies, and archives, Teaching the History of the Book is the first collection of its kind dedicated to book history pedagogy. Presenting a variety of methods for teaching book history, both as its own subject and as an approach to other material, each chapter describes lessons, courses, and programs centered on the latest and best way of teaching undergraduate and graduate students. Matteo Pangallo is Associate Professor of English at Virginia Commonwealth University, and Emily Todd is Dean of the School of Arts and Sciences at Eastern Connecticut State University. Matteo and Emily, welcome to New Books Network.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
And before we dive into talking about your book, I would love if you could each introduce yourself. Maybe you can share a little bit with listeners about your own background and the path your education has taken, and maybe your own personal experience with teaching the history of the book.
Sure. Well, so I was unaware that the history of the book was actually a subject until I got to graduate school. My background in English has been mainly in Shakespeare studies and early modern drama and theater history. And it's really hard to do work in Shakespeare without sort of finding yourself dipping into or adjacent to book history approaches and the study of the history of the text. But it wasn't until I was in graduate school at UMass Amherst when I took a course in book history with Professor Joe Black, and it really opened up my eyes to this incredible world. You know, I grew up surrounded by books. My mom was an academic librarian, so books were a central part of my life growing up. But I was really excited to learn that history of the book was an entire field of study and a methodology. And as soon as I graduated from my doctoral program, I sought out every opportunity I could to either teach courses in book history or incorporate it into my other courses.
Super. Thank you. Emily?
Great. Thank you. So my story is similar to Matteo's. I also discovered book history in graduate school. I had been an American Studies major as an undergraduate. And I, even though I chose to then go on to do a PhD in English, I was really always still drawn to interdisciplinary work. You know, I was kind of going back and forth, should I be American Studies PhD or History PhD, English PhD? And when I was in a American novels class in my very first semester, I came upon a book called Revolution and the Word by Kathy Davidson from the 1980s. And I really loved her work on Charlotte Temple, a novel, an early American novel I had never heard of, because she was paying attention to the number of editions that were printed, to the marginalia, to the early readers of Charlotte Temple. And I was really drawn into learning about the book in history. So it seemed like a field that would allow me to continue to do interdisciplinary research. I had done my Mass MPhil at St. Andrews University in Scottish literature before coming to the University of Minnesota to do my PhD in English. And so I was also interested in transatlantic literary connections. And I ended up doing a dissertation that was a transatlantic literary history in the 19th century. And I focused on the publishing and reading history of Walter Scott's novels. And I did a lot of archival work in Philadelphia at the Library Company, at the Massachusetts Historical Society, at the Richmond Library Company, reading old library borrowing records, looking at publishing records, reading letters by people who talked about their reading, and particularly their reading of the Waverly novels. So my dissertation was a book history dissertation. I had a chance to take an American Antiquarian summer seminar. I think it was in 1997 when I was still in graduate school, and that connected me to a book history community. And then when I took my first job at Westfield State University, where I was an English professor for many years, I proposed an honors book history class right away. And I think I also did also take another American Antiquarian seminar on teaching the history of the book with Scott Casper and Jeffrey Groves. So I had all of that background that I brought to this collection, even though I mostly taught American literature survey classes, so courses in which I used book history methods, but I only had the opportunity to teach standalone book history classes a few times. Well, I'll just also add, Matteo was talking about his family background. My father was an editor. And so as a little girl, he was both a magazine editor and a book editor. And as a little girl, I have memories of being in the Atlantic Monthly offices where he was meeting with editors, with writers. And then I overheard a lot of conversations growing up between my father and the writers he edited. So I think I was also drawn to thinking about how a book is made and who the different actors are in the book trade, because I had an up-close view of relationships between authors and editors and publishers and their imagined readers as I was growing up. So thank you.
Yeah, amazing. I mean, growing up with books in whatever fashion is so wonderful. So then turning to your book, Teaching the History of the Book, this is a really, really ambitious seeming project. I don't know if you would agree, but there's over 35 chapters. There's about 50 contributors. And so I'm really curious just how this project came about, how you connected over this, and what some of your original goals were for it.
Sure. So, you know, as I said, when I finished my doctoral program, I started teaching book history courses. I taught one at Mount Holyoke College and then at Bates College, and ultimately at VCU, where I am now. And when I started out, I really wanted to find some kind of resource that would help me know how other instructors, my colleagues, were teaching book history, and what worked and what didn't work, and what some of the sort of the principles were in terms of learning objectives, methods of evaluation, activities, things like that. And there was not a lot of that out there. It was a fairly straightforward matter to say to people I knew, hey, could I see your syllabus? But I was interested in something that was a little bit more reflective. And so eventually, when I was in a position where I had been teaching book history for a while, I thought there are probably other instructors starting out in the field, or maybe other instructors like me who've been doing it for a little while, who would be would benefit from having this kind of a resource. And so I thought it would be nice to have an edited collection of this kind that reaches across different disciplines and different institution types and different teaching contexts. And I asked Emily to join me as a co-editor in this, because partially because of her own work as a scholar in book history and her experience as a scholar, but also from what I knew of her as a teacher and as a collaborator, because she was the chair of the English department at Westfield State University when I was teaching there briefly after my doctoral program. So I asked her to come on board. We put out an open call for papers. We received something like almost 100 abstracts. I mean, it was a really incredible response. It was, you know, an embarrassment of riches trying to narrow it down to the chapters that were not only the strongest chapters, but also that worked really well together in the different parts of the book that we wanted to cover. So that's how it started on my side.
Yeah, I was so grateful that Matteo invited me to co-edit this collection with him. It came at a time when I was just beginning my work as a dean. I was a dean at Westfield State before moving to my new position. And someone told me early on how important it was when you begin administrative work to stay connected to your scholarship, because that helps to remind you of the central work of the institution. And so this was the perfect project for me to do at that point, because it allowed me on the weekends to read over proposals when the essays came in, work on suggesting edits and working with Matteo on structuring the book. But it also allowed me to connect with scholars around the country and the world even. And it helped me learn about the innovative pedagogical practices that people were using in their classrooms, and also even helped me think about advocacy for the humanities at a time when we need to advocate for the important work that happens in humanities classrooms. So it was really an ideal project for me to get involved with. So I'm grateful to Matteo for his vision and for really all of the organizational work he did to make sure that we stayed on target and got the book out the door. So thank you.
Yeah, I'm sure it was a feat of organization. And it did really feel like I was, getting a chance to sit in a lot of people's classrooms and watch them teach and hear them reflect about it, which was really, really amazing.
We really loved that part of the book, the fact that people really were inviting us into their classroom. So it's valuable as a book about teaching book history, and it's valuable as a book generally about teaching, about the various approaches people are taking in their work.
Definitely. So then you organize the chapters of this book into four sections, although you admitted in the introduction that those divisions are a little bit porous and a lot of the chapters could fit in other sections. But could you explain for listeners what those four sections are and what kinds of ideas and expertise about teaching book history readers can find in this volume?
Yes, you're absolutely right that the divisions are porous. And I was reflecting that we moved some chapters around during the course of editing the collection. So some chapters absolutely could have worked in different sections. But we're proud of the way that we divided up the book, because I think it helps people think about the different frameworks for teaching book history. The first section is called Conceptualizing the Teaching of Book History, and it opens with two scholars who were really leaders in establishing the discipline of book history back in the 80s and 90s in the U.S., Leslie Housam and Jonathan Rose. Their two essays give a history of book history and its relevance and ways to make it relevant. Dr. Housam's essay is called When and Where Did We Start Teaching Book History? And Dr. Rose's is called Why We Teach Book History. So we were really pleased that we had those two voices to open the collection. And the other essays in that first section provide different theoretical frameworks for teaching book history. So there's one on teaching Black book history, one on teaching feminist book history, another on global book history, and another one that looks at different printing technologies. The next section is called Teaching Book History as a Class. And so that's the section where readers will get ideas for teaching book history as a standalone course. So those chapters include different methods and approaches that people use in book history courses that are defined as book history courses. But they also learn about different contexts or different approaches you could use. So, for example, there are a couple of essays on periodicals, using periodicals in teaching book history. And there's another one on teaching the history of illustrated text. And there are some that look at teaching book history within particular contexts. For example, teaching book history in a master's program or teaching book history to future librarians. So that's the second section. The third section is called Teaching Book History in Other Courses. So this is the section where you have writers who might, for example, be describing approaches to teaching a survey of American women's literature and how they use book history methods in teaching that survey, or teaching the British One survey or children's literature. I love this section in particular because that was my experience teaching book history. I did not have the luxury of teaching many standalone courses, as I said earlier, but I did always try to incorporate book history methods. So I think this section gives readers really practical strategies that they can use right away in courses that they regularly teach. And the final section is entitled Resources for Teaching Book History. And this includes a range of essays, many of them reviewing digital resources that are available. For example, there's one on teaching digital resources for teaching African-American book history, or digital illustrations. And there's an essay on the London Rare Book School. Of course, ideas in the section about teaching book history of a course help to conceptualize the field, and all of the essays include resources that will be valuable to people in their teaching, and ideas in teaching book history as a course, a standalone course, will also work in teaching non-book history courses. So yes, there's lots of crossover, lots of ways that the essays inform each other. I do hope and think, though, that the structure helps people navigate the book well and figure out where to go. As you said, there are 35 chapters. It's a packed book. So we wanted to help people navigate the topic.
Yeah, and we wanted it to be especially useful. I mean, that's the primary purpose for a book like this. And I think, you know, as Emily described, breaking it into those sections helps move it towards usefulness. I would just also add that, you know, given the capaciousness of the subject of book history, because that can mean almost anything, it was really hard not just to structure the volume like this, but also to think about what we wanted to include or not include. And I think, you know, one of the things that we point out in the introduction is that we don't make any pretensions towards being comprehensive at all. We had to be highly selective. And one of the things, and this is particularly true for the resources section, we wanted readers to come away with an idea of about how to go about evaluating other resources that we don't talk about, or thinking about other tools that are out there that we don't cover in the book. So that was also an important factor in the way it was structured.
Definitely. Yeah. And one other thing that you note in the introduction is that in addition to these four sections, there's also five themes that really come through. And you mentioned interdisciplinarity, collaboration, media, experiential, and diversity. Could you talk a little bit more about those themes and maybe share some examples of how they're addressed?
Sure. Those themes came about after we had the essays in hand. Actually, we started to see them with the abstracts, but definitely when we got the full essays and we realized, oh, here are some connective threads. And I think we point them out in the introduction because I think for teachers thinking about designing a course or a learning activity in book history, it can be helpful to think about some of those common principles or concepts. Right away, interdisciplinarity is such a crucial part. You can tell from just that if you look at the section about the contributors and everybody's background, there are all kinds of fields of expertise that are coming into this book and teaching. And book history itself is an interdisciplinary subject by definition. Leslie Howsam calls it an interdiscipline, not a discipline. It combines methodologies, theories, objectives from all these different fields of study. And successful teaching in book history really depends on having the ability to draw selectively upon those disciplinary intersections. I think sometimes particularly new instructors might be intimidated by there are so many possible directions to go. They might feel like, well, we need to go in every direction. It's important to be selective. And so readers of the collection will find strategies for course design and classroom planning that provide a broad awareness of book history's interdisciplinary nature, but also how to customize those disciplinary intersections to suit their own learning objectives and contexts. So there are lots of examples of this in the book. Laura Estel has a chapter, What is the Value of a Text?, which describes a learning activity that she uses to get students thinking critically about the idea of a book's value, whatever that word might mean, as a literary work, as a collector's item, as a commodity. And so that activity draws on ideas from economic theory, textual criticism, distinguishing between text and document. Also, Emily mentioned the chapter Teaching the History of Illustrated Texts by Molly Hand. That one is really interesting. I'm an early modernist, and so this chapter is about early modern texts, so it's really interesting to me, at least. It uses media studies intersecting with sort of art criticism and literary studies, as well as history, to teach about 16th and 17th century ballads, and thinking about them as kind of like early modern memes, which I thought was pretty neat. The other theme, so the second theme, was collaboration. Many of the contributors to the volume address the challenges of book history's interdisciplinary nature by engaging in collaborative teaching. And again, you can see that in the table of contents. We have those chapters that are co-written. Book history courses often involve teaching from instructors in literature, history, rhetoric, and other scholarly fields, alongside librarians, rare book librarians, archivists, conservators, book artists, printers, and others in sort of more practice-oriented disciplines. Team teaching, collaborating and teaching in that manner is really excellent when it's possible, because it provides students with exposure to different types of expertise while also modeling the kind of collaborative, cooperative research and thinking that is often the hallmark of effective scholarship, not just in the physical and social sciences, but also quite often in the humanities as well. So the chapter Book History in the Making by Mark Allen, Mattis, Delinda Bowie, and Rachel Single is a great example of this. In that chapter, an English professor, a rare books curator, and a visual artist and arts professor describe a course that they co-taught at the University of Louisville. In that class, they draw on all three of their particular fields to help students think about the physical form of books by having students make and unmake and alter books, which is a pretty neat idea. That leads into media, which is that third theme. Obviously, one of the field's sort of foundational premises is that the material form of the book, whatever that might be, communicates some kind of meaning, that the book is not merely a vessel for the text that it contains. And contributors in the volume frequently return to that premise, making the materiality of the text sort of fundamental to their teaching, whether they're teaching about a papyrus scroll or a clay tablet or a printed codex or a manuscript page or a tattooed skin or a string of knots or a computer file, even the spoken word. So our volume takes a very broad, capacious perspective on the book, which is important to a lot of the contributors. So an example of this focus on media, there's a whole range of them. As I mentioned, that chapter, Book History in the Making, is a good example. Another one is The Printed Word Endures, which is written by a hand press printer, Joseph Beery. He talks about how he uses the process of teaching hand press printing to also teach about how books evolve in the form that they're in codex form. Ryan Cordell's chapter, Programmable Type, it's a really fantastic chapter. It talks about this sort of helping students see the links between the craft and labor of hand press printing and the craft and labor of writing computer code, which is a great way to make book history relevant for a new generation. And that ties into that next theme, right? Experiential learning. Obviously, book history frequently involves the sort of engagement and examination of material objects, a lot of sort of learning by doing and students doing their own research and then their own reflection on that research. So contributors talk about experiential learning being taking students to a book-related site or having them work sort of inductively with a book or a manuscript, engage in a problem-based or role-playing exercise, doing their own archival research and so forth. The best book history courses balance the conceptual with the experiential to help students see how those two things are really linked to each other. And again, there's a lot of examples in the collection. One great example, Alex Mueller and Cheryl Nixon's The Uninhibited Archive, looks at a co-taught course that is centered around having students learn about and then prepare their own public exhibitions of rare books. So thinking about sort of public humanities, public facing humanities. I love concepts like that that sort of move away from the more traditional write a final essay model of evaluating student learning. That's something that I really enjoy. Also, another really interesting chapter that engages with experiential learning, Claire Mullaney's Accessibility and Teaching Book History, which proposes some really, I think, really cool, radical new ideas about student-made editions and how that process of making these additions can help students with learning and physical differences succeed in the book history classroom. And that sort of brings me into that last fifth category of diversity, right? So as a subject that transcends boundaries, but also relies on the kind of particularities of social context and political context, book history requires an engagement with the diversity of textual cultures and also diversity of methodologies and disciplines. But books are, you know, as we all know, they're simultaneously intensely personal, but also intensely impersonal, right? They are subjective belongings that are bound up with notions of our identity and ourself, but they're also these objective materials that reflect and shape these larger scale currents of culture and commerce. And because of this, book history is inclusive or needs to be inclusive of a diverse range of voices and identities. And a lot of the contributors to the collection, as Emily was mentioning, center their teaching of book history on addressing contexts of gender, socioeconomic status, ability, nationality, race, and ethnicity, and draw attention to that sort of the importance of considering book history from many perspectives, but also cultivating thoughtfulness about how students of book history in our classrooms are coming from many different cultural and social backgrounds with many different kinds of experiences of the book. So one particular chapter is sort of that is a real standout to me in terms of addressing questions of diversity in the book history class. There's a bunch of them, but Jiwon Wu's chapter, Toni Morrison's Lorraine, I think is really an interesting one. For one thing, she teaches that at a community college, which is a type of institution that is by its nature, both inherently diverse, but also highly resource challenged compared to other institutions. And her solution, her innovative solution to the problem of limited resources, is she talks about turning the community itself, the community that the community college is in, into a resource and having students engage in place-based learning to make discoveries about a book. In this case, the history of Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye, but also sort of more broadly, the history of the Black book in America, rooted in that sense of and specific community that she's teaching in. So those are the sort of broadly describe those five themes that you pointed out and that we mentioned in the introduction. Those are just a couple of the chapters that I saw that pick up on those as good examples.
Thank you so much. Yeah, it's such a rich collection of ideas and voices and experiences. And one of the other things that became evident while reading the book is the impact of the moment we're living in. Much of the book was written during the COVID pandemic, at a point where most teaching was online. And that specific moment is part of, I guess, a bigger shift towards digital teaching modes. And so what are some of the ways that we see contributors in the book navigating the changing landscape of digital instruction? And what are some of the tools that the book provides for instructors who are teaching the book either online or with online tools?
That's a great question. Mateo likes to say in his own teaching, right, that every book has a history, and this book, teaching the history of the book, has a particular history that overlaps with the pandemic. We were selecting essays. I was casting my mind back to April, I think it was April of 2019, when we selected the abstracts. And I can't remember when the first round of essays came in, but it must have been during the early days of the pandemic. I remember sending lots of emails to people saying, I hope you're safe. How's everything going with you? And but we were beginning to read drafts right during the pandemic. And it became clear to us as we were revising the first version of the manuscript that we had one big gap, which was we did not have an essay on teaching book history online. So the 30 39, however many essays we accepted up front, did not include one that was focused on teaching book history online. And it seemed crucial then at that point, right, to make sure that we addressed head on that topic. So we solicited an essay by Matt Carter, which is called Book History Online, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the ROM. So that one, you know, was one way in which we directly addressed the pandemic moment we were all in. But I would add that many of the contributors went back to their essays and added what they learned from that experience in the spring of 2020 of transitioning their courses online. One person who really revised her essay substantially in response to the pandemic was Leah Price, who provides the afterword for the book. And Mateo, I think I'm remembering right that it's a substantially different essay than the one that she, submitted. It's called Book Learning. And she really directly addresses what happened in her teaching, how that changed. Throughout the collection, contributors talk about digital resources that they bring into their teaching. Mateo and I were both aware of the wide variety of institutions in which people teach book history. And some people might have access to rare book rooms at their institutions and or in their communities. If you're teaching in New York City or if you're teaching in Philadelphia, you have access to a lot of physical resources, but we have contributors who are teaching at a range of institutions, many institutions without rare book libraries or under-resourced institutions. And back in the 90s, when I started to do research, I couldn't depend on digital archives, but now many teachers are able to access pretty extensive digital resources. So the fourth section on resources for teaching book history includes a lot of reviews of digital archives that are available. And many people will speak about, in their essays, right, about the particular digital resources that they bring into their teaching, whether that be the periodicals in Barbara Huckham's essay on teaching in a periodical context, or as Mateo mentioned, the ballads, the illustrations that Molly Hand speaks about. So throughout the book, there are resources that people can use for teaching online. I'm going to turn it over to Mateo to reflect on one other way in which teaching online or teaching synchronously online virtually changes the approach to book history, because he's had a more recent experience than I of teaching book history online. So Mateo?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to think about, because I learned book history. And I think the way most people teach book history is like you bring that box of show and tell objects into the classroom and you spread them out on the table, or you take the students to the rare book room. And I think that's it can be a very effective way, obviously. But one of the things that I've learned over the course of the pandemic and teaching book history online is that there is another way to do it, which is, instead of emphasizing this idea that doing book history means working with rare books or old books, is having students work with their own books, the books that they have access to that are near to them. And so they can see that every copy of every book has a history to it. And the study of book history, of course, is trying to learn that story and understand how it intersects with the story inside the book. And, you know, teaching online, it kind of forces you into a position of helping students understand that. At the same time, the you know, as Emily was just mentioning, the range of tools and resources that are available now is radically different than it was even 5 years ago. And putting an emphasis on helping students learn how to navigate those tools as they do book history work, I think, is also an important approach to teaching online. The other thing that I would add that is a benefit to teaching digitally or online is that this is where a lot of the students are. It's you know, what students are very familiar with. We talk in the introduction about the sort of the transformational opportunities in book history that are provided by defamiliarizing the most familiar object in a student's educational and often personal experience. And I think for teachers of a certain generation, we assume that means the codex book, the codex form. But I think that for many of our students now, and definitely in the future, that means thinking about books digitally. You know, what does the digital book look like? And so I think helping to meet students partway there makes the subject intrinsically more interesting and directly relevant to them, because it can be absolutely interesting. It can be a thrill of a lifetime to handle a vellum-bound book from the 1500s, and for a student to like learn about how that book was bound or how the printing process worked and why that's important. But I think in terms of what the students then carry away from the class, because most of our students are not going to become book historians, but I still want them to find ideas in book history that are useful throughout the rest of their life. So helping them see the relevance of the subject and the methodology beyond just the context of looking at older rare books is extremely valuable. And also, as any instructor will know, when a student finds intrinsic pleasure or relevance in the subject that they're studying, they do better at it, right? They have more invested in it, but of their own, volition. So those are some of the things that I've been thinking about a lot with teaching online. Yes, there are trade-offs. The materiality piece changes dramatically, but I think that change reflects how the future of the book is also changing in light of the history of the book.
Absolutely.
We begin the collection by telling stories about taking our students on field trips, taking them to rare book rooms. I think you took them to a printing press and visit a newspaper. So we spoke in our book about introducing our students to the materiality of the text and bringing them to these places where they can encounter rare books. But I think the chapters in the collection show similar kinds of discoveries that students are making through the digital resources that are available and through the classroom approaches, methodologies that these contributors are using. We've seen a real transformation in our time as professors, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. So this book has been out now for a year, and I would really love to hear about the life of this book so far. I'm curious if you've had any opportunities to see this book inspire workshops or conversations, new teaching practices, course plans or anything else.
Yeah, I mean, I will say we were very fortunate. UMass Press was absolutely wonderful to work with. And the book was released in paperback at the same time that it was released in hardcover, which is not always the case with scholarly academic publications. And I think that greatly helped in terms of providing access to the book in terms of its price point and ensuring that people who wanted it could get it. I know of a number of colleagues of mine, particularly in the fields of early modern studies, but also beyond that, who have been drawing on the book, incorporating their ideas into their teaching practices, not just in book history classes, but also sort of finding ways to bring the book history approaches our contributors talk about into classes that, as Emily mentioned, are more sort of the bread and butter courses they teach all the time, whether that's gen ed or surveys and things like that. So I've heard from many colleagues who are very grateful for what our contributors have shared. Over the past year, we've had the good fortune to hold a couple of talks and roundtables with selective contributors. So at the University of Connecticut, Emily and I gave a talk on the book. The Five College Book History Seminar at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, we held a hybrid roundtable with is it 8 or 9 contributors? I can't remember how many.
That sounds right. Yeah.
And we held a roundtable for the Book Club of California, which was fantastic. That was a virtual roundtable with a very large number of people attending. The VCU Humanities Research Center, which was one of the funders for the collection, also hosted a virtual roundtable where we had 8 or 9 contributors, other contributors come together. And those roundtables, I think those experiences were a lot of fun because putting even putting an edited collection together. Writing any academic book can often be a lonely or solitary experience. Putting an edited collection together, there's a bit more sense of community, but a lot of it is sort of by Zoom or by, one-on-one by Zoom or by exchanging drafts by email and so forth. Having a group of the contributors come together and talk together and share their thoughts and also respond to one another's ideas was really, really rewarding to see them making connections between the work that they did.
I would add that the contributors are all really excited to be in the collection and to read one another's work. I've heard a lot of people are the contributors themselves are learning from one another as they work through the book. And we certainly hope that the workshops and that the book will have a long life. I'll finally, I'll skip over that final thought and go to the next question.
Sure. Yeah. We're just about at the end. I don't want to take too much more of your time, but I guess before we wrap up, I would love to hear if there are other projects that you're working on now. This was clearly a really big project that I'm sure occupied a lot of your time. So I'm curious if now, you know, there's new things on your plate that you're working on now that this is done, or if you're working on any projects that have evolved out of this volume. Emily, do you want to go first?
So as I said at the beginning, I'm in a dean role now, and I do not have a new scholarly project. I have a lot of grant projects that I'm involved in right now and supporting grants that we've just received. So a National Endowment for the Humanities grant that's connected to curricular development for humanities students in light of AI, navigating AI, and another MLA grant that's about recruiting students to the English major. And then because I am a dean also for STEM disciplines, I am deeply involved in an NSF grant. So that's where my focus is. I hope to go back to some of the letters I identified in my dissertation research for readers, letters that didn't make their way into any of my publications so far, but were really rich documents from the 1820s about people's reading experiences. And those are materials that I have that I haven't fully finished working with. So I hope to find space and to follow the guidance I got from a colleague years ago that a dean should still stay connected to scholarship. So that's the project I have in the back of my mind. Mateo?
I'm going to be teaching the history of the book again this coming fall as an upper level undergraduate course. And I've already started incorporating some things from the collection into how I teach it because I taught it this past fall. I am going to go back and revisit because I think that there are a handful of ideas that some of the contributors mentioned that I haven't had the chance to use yet. And I am looking to refresh that course. So I'm going to be pulling some thoughts from the volume. I'm also teaching a graduate course this fall on scholarly editing, which I've been very excited to do. Obviously, that's a subject that's quite close to book history. I'm doing some editing work right now on three plays for the Oxford Collected Works of Thomas Heywood. And scholarly editing is sort of a part and parcel of Shakespeare studies. So it's something I've been involved with for a while over my career. I do have another edited or co-edited collection that is coming out with the University of Alabama Press this fall, called None a Stranger There, England and in Europe on the Early Modern Stage, which is a collection of essays about early modern drama in light of reading those plays in the light of Brexit and the rise of neo-nationalism. And the contributors to that are fantastic. They're from Europe, they're from England, they're from North America. It's a great collection that I'm really proud of. My monograph project is my second monograph is in the revision stage right now, getting ready to go to a press. And that project is not in book history, really. It's called Strange Company, Foreign Performers in Medieval and Early Modern England. And it's a study of sort of performers, so dancers, musicians, actors, animal acts, pyrotechnics, acrobatics from Europe and abroad who came into Shakespeare's England and medieval England, and the role that their cultural performances played in shaping English cultural identity in that period, sort of looking at performance in immigrant communities in early England, as well as the movement of itinerant professional troops of musicians and minstrels and dancers and actors from the continent to England. So that book is in its ugly draft stage right now, and I'm moving it from ugly draft to readable.
Fantastic. Well, it sounds like you both have a lot on your plates. Thank you so much for chatting with me today. Once again, I've been speaking with Emily Todd and Matteo Pangallo, editors of Teaching the History of the Book, published by University of Massachusetts Press in 2023. My name is Jen Hoyer, and you're listening to New Books Network.